Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the Chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Clint Werner. Clint Werner was born and raised in North Carolina, where he earned a BA in journalism and a master's degree in library science and research. He studied macrobiotics in Boston and settled in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he worked cooking, writing, and teaching about natural foods and health. During the depths of the AIDS crisis, Clint was caregiver to his best friend who was dying from the disease. Seeing how much marijuana helped his friend move Clint to become active in the medical marijuana political movement. Beginning in 1996, Clint began researching and documenting the history of the medical marijuana movement, a seemingly never-ending story. While covering the politics and science surrounding medical marijuana, Clint became increasingly aware of the growing body of research which indicates that using marijuana is health-positive behavior and decided to write Marijuana Gateway to Health as a concise collection of his surprising information. His writing has appeared in Cannabis Therapeutics in HIV/AIDS, the Journal of Cannabis Therapeutics, Macrobiotics Today, Canine Chronicle, and other publications. Clint has been named Activist of the Month for June by NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And now, Clint Werner.
Thank you so very, very much, Bill, for that introduction and for inviting me here and facilitating this appearance. And I just want to also thank the Commonwealth Club for allowing me to present this information. It really is amazing and somewhat startling what we are learning about marijuana, cannabis. I'd just like to say to begin with, my relationship with the Commonwealth Club goes back about 16 years when I was out front protesting against General Barry McCaffrey, the drug czar's appearance here, while he was on a campaign to squelch the medical marijuana movement. He was touring around, and his sound bites were that there's no evidence whatsoever that marijuana is safe or effective for people with AIDS, and that this entire medical marijuana movement is just a Cheech and Chong show. And I'd like to give you the evidence that shows just how very wrong he is today, how mistaken he's been. So I'd like to just begin with a little bit of history about marijuana, the cannabis plant, and how we got to where we are today. Cannabis, the plant, seems to have originated in the Hindu Kush area, the Himalayas, the region surrounding western China, the foothills of the Himalayan region, and that it sprung up here and began to be embraced for medicinal and spiritual use and also practical use because the seeds are very rich in nutrients and the fiber is very strong and used for rope, fiber, and other things like that. And so it became an integral part of human civilization fairly quickly and migrated, perhaps with the Aryans, into India, where it really found a welcome home. And the climate of India allowed this plant to flourish and reach its maximum potential, the warm, long seasons, the fertile soil. And it became a mainstay in Indian culture. It was a very, very vital plant. It was used for, once again, food, medicine, spiritual pursuits. It was used for all sorts of medicinal remedies because that's what you had, plants in those days. And from there, the plant seems to have spread out up into the Middle East and then to Portugal and maybe with the Portuguese sailors to Africa. And so it's just sort of spread out through human culture. And when it reached Northern Europe quite a while back, it was mainly used for rope. It was hemp for rope. There isn't a large body of evidence suggesting that the psychoactive or medicinal aspects were employed in Europe until during the colonization period, Irish physician W.B. O'Shaughnessy was working in India for the British Crown, and he observed that the people of India were using this remedy for a broad range of illnesses, seizures, stomach disorders, nervous disorders, lockjaw from tetanus, rabies, hydrophobia that comes from rabies. So he was pretty amazed that there was this remedy that was so vital to the life of the Indian population. So he began doing some observational studies and confirmed that there is serious biological activity with this plant and its extracts. He began writing it up and shipping it back to Great Britain. British pharmaceutical companies began to employ using it, began to ship it in from India and making concentrated remedies known as Indian hemp remedies. And these became used in Great Britain and then moved to the United States. In the United States, they became pretty popular in the late 1800s. You had Indian hemp concentrate, and it was used for menstrual problems, seizures, nervous agitation disorders, which sort of presage Alzheimer's generally, and all types of illnesses that we now see it still being turned to for today. So it was really a popular remedy at this time, but there were some problems. Standardization was kind of difficult because the plant, depending if it's grown in a more sunny area or an area that gets less sun, that varies the amount of medicinal resins that the plant produces. So that was one of the difficulties. And then when synthetic drugs became popular and started coming into the pharmacopoeia and the syringe was used, became a frequent way to deliver medicines, the hemp remedies began to fall out of favor to a degree because they are not suitable for injection. They're far too sticky and viscous. They're not water-soluble. And so they kind of fell somewhat out of favor. They were still being used. But at that time, prohibition of alcohol ended, and there were a lot of federal agents who didn't have a job. And so the Bureau of Narcotics was a division of the Treasury. It was formed. And Harry Anslinger, who was the son-in-law of the Secretary of the Treasury, was given the job of eradicating marijuana. And this was a way to make work, and it was also grew out of a really malignant racist attitude that these people had, because marijuana was hemp. It is cannabis, but it was in a form that was used socially and also palatively by Mexicans and sailors from the Indies and from the former slaves, especially down in New Orleans and the southern states. There was an area called Storyville, and marijuana was very popular there. It was essentially an integral part of the jazz movement. I'm not sure that we would really have jazz as we know it if we had never had marijuana. Louis Armstrong was a 5-cigar-size joint a day user, and he attributed much of his insight and understanding of music to the use of marijuana. So it was demonized, and this campaign was launched to eradicate marijuana, loco weed, reefers. It was said that it made white women have relationships with black men. It made Mexicans go crazy and axe murder white people. Just this whole campaign of calumny and deceit was foisted upon the American public. Randolph Hearst, his papers, printed numerous yellow journalism stories about the horrors of marijuana. And so Congress moved to criminalize marijuana and eradicate it in response to this outcry. The AMA opposed it. When the hearings were being held, a representative for the AMA opposed it because it would put off limits a whole family of remedies that had not really reached its potential yet. It would take it completely off the market and out of the pharmacopoeia. Well, the representative who was moving to have this passed, Vinson, testified that the AMA were completely on board with this, and it passed. So the way that marijuana was criminalized was through a tax act. The government enacted a tax on marijuana that was unfeasible to pay because it was so large and was also impossible to pay because they didn't make the stamps required to show you had paid the tax available. So there was a little catch-22 they devised. And so this was how marijuana was initially criminalized. And in response to this, Mayor LaGuardia in New York commissioned a study of marijuana to see what it really did, and he came to the opposite conclusions of what the hysterics had been saying, that it wasn't significantly harmful, it didn't cause any degenerative illnesses, it didn't cause any of the sort of social or mental aberrations that were attributed to it. The AMA printed LaGuardia's results, but then came under heavy pressure from the Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement to toe the line and get on board with marijuana prohibition. They used their power to go after doctors for other narcotics violations, and they really increased their prosecution of doctors for narcotics in order to bully the AMA into accepting this position. So that's where we were. And for a number of years, marijuana was stigmatized. It was portrayed as dope. It was, you know, the commies were using it to ruin America. And it's sort of just the medical, it was removed from the pharmacopoeia in 1942, and the medical aspects went dormant. No one seemed to remember or care about them. It was consigned to marginal societies, marginal groups, and that's how people felt, that it was dope. It was like heroin, it was dope. And then what happened was the Beats came along, and they began to turn on because they were sort of cross-pollinating with African-American culture and the countercultural movement and political outcasts. And they sort of embraced this whole world and digested it and brought about an art form, beat poetry and beat literature. And Allen Ginsberg was a big mover in this, and he was a huge proponent of marijuana once he tried it. He wrote an article that he talked about the eye kicks you get from marijuana, how it makes things going to a museum great because it stimulates your visual response to art and your psychological response. And he began protesting and suggesting that the laws were horribly out of touch with reality. So about the same time, other people began embracing it who were a little more mainstream, i.e. Caucasian. And some of these people, we have a couple here, Mike and Michelle Aldridge, locally, and they were integral in developing the group Lamar, Legalized Marijuana. So it was becoming a little more acceptable for mainstream middle-class people to use, especially young people. And this really seemed to center around a lot of this came in the Ivy League schools because they had, the students had, a lot of them had interest in bohemianism and counterculture. So marijuana found its way into Harvard and other universities, and young white kids, middle-class white kids, started using it, and the use of it grew fairly rapidly. And Harvard's very interesting because so much happened there. That's where there was a psychiatrist who had just finished a textbook on schizophrenia, and Dr. Grinspoon, Lester Grinspoon, and he saw these young people using marijuana, which he just thought was terrible because these were some of the best and brightest minds of a generation, and he thought that we were really going to have a problem in the future if their brains were destroyed with marijuana. So he thought, I'll write a paper that will convince them to turn away from marijuana, give them scholarly arguments and a real reason to not use it. So he started researching it, and he got hold of a book, The Hemp Papers, by Dr. Todd Micaria, who had worked for the National Institute of Mental Health, and copied everything they had on marijuana that was kind of suppressed and published it. And he did the research, and he came to the conclusion, there's nothing wrong with this. Why are we acting like this over this substance? And so instead of publishing a paper against it, he wrote Marijuana Reconsidered. And this was a profound texts that really challenged our understanding of what marijuana did in the human body and why we had the social policies we did. So from that point, marijuana use was growing at Harvard, and there was a young grad student, Dr. Andrew Weil, who gave me a very good endorsement for my book, for which I thank him. But Andrew Weil, he decided that there needed to be some solid medical research conforming to the new type of medical research. In other words, double-blind studies had become implemented in order to get unbiased results from medical research, in which the researcher doesn't know who's getting what substance and the subject doesn't know who's getting what substance until the study's over. And so he decided to use some double-blind methodology, and he fought Harvard. Harvard wouldn't let him do the study, so he did it at, Boston College. And they did allow him to do the study. He did the study, and he found out there's no significant harm from it. It raises blood pressure slightly or lowers blood pressure sometimes and raises heart rate, and that there's just no significant harm. And he also found that people who are regular users of marijuana frequently perform certain activities better while they're under the influence of marijuana. So he published that study, and then Timothy Leary, who was the big proponent of psychedelics, around that time, a little earlier, he was arrested going from Texas into Mexico by the U.S. authorities for having one joint, and it was under the Tax Act, the federal, because it was federal customs agents. And he was sentenced to, I believe, 37 years in prison for it, for one joint. He appealed it on the grounds that this is double jeopardy, because if he had paid the tax for the joint, which you couldn't do anyway, but if he had, he would be declaring himself guilty of violating Texas's anti-marijuana laws, so that this conflict was untenable and unconstitutional. So the justices threw out the Marijuana Tax Act in 1969, just in time for Woodstock. So during 1969, there were no federal laws against marijuana. So 1970, John Mitchell, under the direction of Richard Nixon, constructed the Controlled Substances Act. Marijuana was put in the most restrictive category, Schedule 1, having no medical use and a high level of abuse, threat of abuse. This seemed pretty ridiculous to a lot of people, so a commission was established to look at this and see where marijuana should be placed. It was sort of put in Schedule 1, there on the side of caution. The commission was the Schaefer Commission. Nixon appointed a number of members of this panel. He appointed right-wing ideologues, stacked it with right-wing ideologues who would come back against marijuana. But these people looked at marijuana. They researched it. They went to Afghanistan and met with hash producers, and actually some of them smoked hash with an Afghani tribal lord. And they came back, and they produced a report that said marijuana should be legalized for personal use and small amounts of exchange between friends, and there should be some restrictions on large-scale distribution, but that overall the criminalization was doing far more harm than it was good, and that we needed to deal with this. So back to Harvard. Right about this time, Lester Grinspoon, who had written Marijuana Reconsidered, his son got ill with leukemia and was vomiting after every treatment and was reluctant to go and continue treatment. He heard through the grapevine that there was a leukemia patient in Texas who had been getting marijuana and had responded really well and not had nausea. So Lester's wife went to the local high school, got some kids to score a joint for, had her son smoke it before his next chemo treatment. He didn't throw up, and on the way home, he asked to stop and get a submarine sandwich, which Lester couldn't believe. He said, "What's going on?" And she told him, and from then on, the doctors allowed him to smoke in the chemotherapy ward. So this is how the renaissance of medical marijuana started. The popular social use intersected with people serendipitously who happened to be ill. Another one of those was Robert Randall. He was a young college student in the D.C. area. He had glaucoma. He was losing his vision fairly rapidly. None of the available medicines were working. He went over to a friend's house, smoked a joint, walked home, and noticed that the halos around streetlights that are symptomatic of increased pressure weren't there. And every time he tried marijuana, his vision improved and the halos disappeared. So he started growing marijuana. He was arrested. He fought it under medical necessity. He won. He sued the government, and he established the Compassionate IND program that provided him with marijuana as a research subject. He had to get a doctor who agreed to conduct research on him, even though the government never looked at the research, but it was sort of a way to get him in and allow him to have marijuana after he threatened to sue them. This was, in a sense, to his mind, he saw it as a way to get other people on. He could have stopped and kept his marijuana, kept his sight, and been quiet, but he went out and he raised hell. And he recruited people and doctors to try and get on the Compassionate IND program. The government was very resistant. They regularly lost paperwork that was submitted by doctors for patients. And, I mean, one, two, three times. And then when it got through, they would send it back saying, you've made a mistake. It could be a slight punctuation error, but they wouldn't tell them what it was. But it was just this whole wall put up to keep anyone from getting on. But people did get on. They persisted. And a few people got on. Irv Rosenfeld, who has a illness that causes spikes to grow on his bones, tumor spikes, and he found that the using marijuana stopped the growth of the spikes and relieved his pain. He got on. L.V. Musica, another glaucoma patient. And then we got to the point where AIDS hit. And AIDS was really sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in this, because marijuana worked for AIDS patients. I've seen it. It stimulates appetite. It lets them eat, and it keeps them alive. And so a young couple came to Robert Randall, Barbara and Kenny Jinks, and he was a hemophiliac who had gotten AIDS through transfusions. They were married. They were monogamous. They were high school sweethearts. And they became perfect spokespeople in an age in which AIDS, people were so fearful of AIDS, and still there was so much homophobia and also the stigma of drug use for other AIDS patients. They were a perfect couple to promote marijuana for AIDS. And so what Robert Randall did was make a form that any doctor could fill out instead of doing this really complicated research and doing the form that they needed to get on the IND. He made it a form that could be filled out for AIDS, a uniform template. And so the AIDS physicians could fill it out, submit it, and they did. And it was sent out to AIDS care organizations throughout the country. And the NIH was flooded with requests for marijuana from AIDS patients, at which point they shut it down and developed the Marinol pill, which they had synthetic THC. They put it into sesame oil, put it into a pill, found a pharmaceutical company to gift it to, and they started producing Marinol. They shut down the IND program and said, no more. Sorry, the ones who are on it can stay. The ones who were applied and approved don't get it. You get Marinol. There was also a federal movement to pass a medical marijuana bill, interestingly enough, that was co-sponsored by a Representative McKinney and Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was an early proponent of marijuana, medical marijuana, and was a real pit bull for it until Ronald Reagan got elected and Nancy Reagan adopted the just say no, and he, being a young aspiring politician, didn't want to get on the wrong side, so he dropped medical marijuana like a hot potato and went over to the other side. So what we had was the AIDS population, and then it was like everything was morbid. Nothing was happening. The federal bill was killed by Henry Waxman, and the Compassionate IND program was closed. That's when Dennis Perone came into the picture. He's a marijuana dealer here in San Francisco, and a gay man who had lost so many friends to AIDS and was providing marijuana for his friends with AIDS. And he was arrested for selling marijuana. His partner, who was in the last stages of AIDS, was brutalized by the police. And he decided that he was a Buddhist pacifist and he needed to figure out a way to get even without being violent. So he came up with the idea that if he could sell marijuana to AIDS patients, then he could humiliate the narcotic squad while providing marijuana to AIDS patients, because every person with AIDS needs marijuana. That's his quote. So he opened up. First, he already had a marijuana shop. That's where I used to get marijuana for my friend who died of AIDS. And he passed locally Prop P, which was a hemp advisory measure that said the city and the people in the city of San Francisco desire the state to make hemp medications available for the patient population again. That passed with about 84% of the vote, and he opened up open marijuana shop and started a medical marijuana dispensary and started promoting it as such, because he knew that if he was arrested, the jury pool is drawn from the voter registration, and 84% of the jurors would be on his side. It grew immensely. People came with all sorts of illnesses and really jumped on the bandwagon. Then from there, he moved to pass Prop 215, and so many people worked on that. There was just a huge effort that came together, and it was the first state medical marijuana proposition, and it passed in 1996. So right before that time, there was also something going on at SF General. Donald Abrams was treating AIDS patients at the dedicated AIDS ward at San Francisco General, and a lot of them were using marijuana. There was a volunteer, Brownie Mary, who provided marijuana brownies to AIDS patients, and she was arrested baking marijuana brownies. Donald saw her arrest on TV. It went national on CNN, actually international. He saw it in Amsterdam at the International AIDS Conference. Rick Doblin of Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies saw it, approached Donald about doing a study of marijuana in AIDS patients. He began trying to do the study but was flummoxed and prevented from this by the bureaucracy, the DEA, NIDA. It was just a really insane pursuit, because the National Institute on Drug Abuse is the only source for research-grade marijuana, and their charter states that they can only provide money and resources for research intended to assess harm. So it is illegal in the United States, it's forbidden essentially, to conduct research on marijuana for beneficial purposes. And that's what he was trying to do, and they wouldn't let him. So he went through and was trying. And as 215 was approaching the election day, Donald was saying that the drug czar is saying that there's no evidence that marijuana is safe and effective, but they're not letting anyone do the research that would prove that it is. So 215 passed, and that's when everything really started to change, because it opened up a whole realm of freedom from which people could experiment and employ cannabis medicines again and could see what they worked for. And more people it was less stigmatized, and people felt safe, and they had safe access. So more people who had ailments decided to see if it worked for them, and they found out it did. Fibromyalgia, migraines, the list continued to grow. Menstrual cramps, all sorts of ailments that people had, they were finding relief from marijuana. Now, in the 60s, no one knew how marijuana did what it did. So a researcher in Israel, Raphael Mechoulam, decided to investigate. And using modern techniques for pulling apart the cannabinoids, because they're quite a sticky, resinous mess. He called it a hard, horrible soup of cannabinoids. It's really hard to isolate. But using modern techniques, he was able to, and isolated CBD, cannabidiol, a cannabinoid, and THC, and then determined tetrahydrocannabinol, that this was the psychoactive component by testing it in monkeys. And he said he was surprised that it was just one component had primary psychoactive activity. But so he established that there were cannabinoids and that these were the active components. Now, no one still knew how they acted in our bodies until 1988, when Alan Howlett and her research assistant, William Devane, found the first cannabinoid receptor, and that was in a rat's brain. And so that told us that we don't have this receptor because marijuana makes cannabinoids. We have it because we make something that interacts with this receptor. And so that was 1988. In 1992, William Devane and Lumir Anus, working in Raphael Mechoulam's lab in Israel, discovered that the first endocannabinoid agent, anandamide, this is the cannabinoid that we make that is sort of the corresponding cannabinoid to THC. And so they found that this docks with the receptors in the human body. In 1993, a group from Cambridge found the second cannabinoid receptor, endocannabinoid receptor. And in 1995, Raphael Mechoulam identified the second endocannabinoid agent, which is 2AG, and he found it in spleen tissue, which was very surprising because people sort of thought that these receptors were primarily located in the central nervous system. But we see that they're actually distributed throughout the body. And so that was very surprising to find it in the spleen tissue. But what they found from there until really about the year 2000, 2003, when they were mapping out, is that these receptors are expressed throughout the body in nearly every system and organ in our body. They are amazing networks for communication that no one ever knew existed before. It's a network that regulates the activity of the body and works to maintain homeostasis, a balance, and harmony in the body. And so we had this plotted, and no one had ever knew it existed before, and so here's a whole new body of science that's just arisen, and the opportunities to exploit it have arisen. Leslie Iverson, the professor of pharmacology at Oxford, said, "From the original goal of studying a psychotropic plant cannabinoid, we now see instead the opportunity of revealing a wholly novel physiological control system in the body." And this explains the broad range of medical claims cited by people for cannabis. So from that point, the research began to see what cannabis does in the body and how it affects the body, even more dedicated research. And amazingly, what researchers have found is that cannabinoids have powerful anti-tumor effects. THC and CBD both work through these receptors to communicate to the body information that down-regulates harmful chemicals that facilitate the viability of cancer cells and tumors, and to upregulate compounds that are hostile to these alien cells, these abnormal cells. And it's really been quite an amazing revelation because there was research that was ignored in 1975 that cannabinoids inhibited lung cancer cells. It was never picked up, never exploited. 1997, a study, the National Toxicology Project, found that the more THC rats and mice ingest, the longer they live with a proportionate decrease in tumors. And so now we see that what happens is these chemicals, as THC connects with the receptors and communicates with the receptors. These are mimics of these chemicals that we have, the endocannabinoids. And the job of the endocannabinoids is to maintain an environment that is hostile to the development of disease and to attack the disease process and interrupt it and stop it when it gets a hold on us. And so what we find is really amazing. Cannabinoids work by reducing inflammation. They also inhibit the ability of cancer cells to produce blood vessels so that they can feed themselves. It's called angiogenesis, and they inhibit a chemical called VEGF that facilitates this. The cannabinoids also inhibit the ability of cancer cells to migrate and spread to other organs. And they, what's even more interesting maybe, is that they selectively target cancer cells for death. It's called apoptosis. And they target these cells for death to get rid of them while sparing and actually nurturing the healthy cells. So this is completely amazing that you have this whole cocktail that works in so many ways. And there's evidence for breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, bile duct cancer, colon cancer, brain cancer, melanoma, lung cancer. So to support this information in my book, what I did was I presented this preclinical data, but then I wanted to boost it. So I looked at the epidemiological data, and what we find is there was a study meant to prove that marijuana causes lung cancer and found that there's actually a 37% reduction in lung cancer in chronic long-term marijuana smokers over non-smokers. And there's a 63% reduction in head and neck cancers in chronic long-term marijuana smokers over non-smokers. And there is a reduction in lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease. And so this supports the activity we've seen. Now, the other area that is really fascinating with regard to marijuana is neurological disease, specifically Alzheimer's. And researchers have found that cannabinoids work to reduce inflammation in the brain and to prevent the accumulation of the plaque that is associated with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a disease that interrupts the flow, the communication in the brain, and the plaque that forms interrupts the nerve pathway, so these this communication doesn't work. And THC goes in and eradicates the plaque and also seems to affect tau, which is another agent that causes the degeneration of brain cells. And even more fascinating, THC triggers adult hippocampal neurogenesis, the production of healthy, functional new brain cells. This is pretty amazing because we've been told that marijuana kills brain cells, causes brain degeneration, when in reality, those studies were done by suffocating monkeys with marijuana smoke, and they actually had oxygen deprivation. But when you look at the introduction of cannabinoids to the human being, you find that they are highly protective of the central nervous system and nourishing of the central nervous system. Researchers who were looking at Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, said that treating the drug would require a cocktail that would work on neurotransmitters, enzymes, inflammation, and neurons. And remarkably, cannabis has activity in all of those areas. So it is really amazing that this plant that has been so denigrated and so attacked can protect the brain from one of the most devastating illnesses that we know. I think Alzheimer's is probably the worst illness there is. You lose your sense of self and you become a vegetable and die a miserable death. So the research for Alzheimer's was done at Scripps, and the researcher said, we don't want to be in the position of recommending that people use an illicit drug, but there's nothing we have available that is as effective as THC for protecting the brain from the changes that come with Alzheimer's. And there was another study with a doctor, neurologist Gary Wink, in Ohio University, and he found that THC is the best available agent for protecting the brain from the changes that result from aging and lead to Alzheimer's disease and similar neurological illnesses. And he said that his colleague, Yannick Marchalant, recommends a puff a day because one puff a day of marijuana is enough to protect the brain from the degeneration associated with Alzheimer's. Now, I also think that it's interesting because there was a huge lawsuit brought by professional football players recently last week against the NFL for allegedly hiding the damage that comes from repeated blows to the head. It's chronic trauma and produces illnesses that are similar to Alzheimer's. It actually produces a lot of tau in the brain. And there's good evidence that THC, especially coupled with the other cannabinoids, CBD, will go in and attack the tau, eliminate it, and trigger the repair mechanisms for the brain. So I say that marijuana, Scientifically speaking, marijuana should be as common in NFL locker rooms as are ice packs. And, you know, it's a controversial and somewhat inflammatory statement, but it's true if you look at science. There's no reason, except for the old bias and bigotry that is aligned against cannabis. So the other thing that I want to mention is that CBD is very promising for diabetic neuropathy, which is the leading cause of blindness in the United States, and also seems to have the quality of delaying and minimizing the onset of diabetic symptoms. So it seems to counteract the changes that come to the body through diabetes. So why is it illegal? Why is this plant still illegal? And why aren't people talking about this? That's why I wrote the book, because I came upon this vast body of data, and it's generally, if it's reported, if a study's reported, it's dismissed with stoner whimsy. Oh, I guess Cheech and Chong won't be getting cancer. Or it's ignored, or it's just reported on and not put into the context of the whole. And what we see is that we have a plant that is an ally of humanity whose compounds match up nearly identically with compounds we generate in our bodies to protect ourselves from serious illness. But government keeps this from us through prohibition. And the thing I just want to say about prohibition is, if you wonder why, maybe it's because the DEA has a $2 billion budget, the National Institute on Drug Abuse has a $1 billion budget, and the ONDCP, the Drug Czar's Office, and I think this is right, I double-checked it, but it's really amazing, $15 billion for the Drug Czar's propaganda machine. And a lot of this money goes into creating pseudoscience to convince people that marijuana is really harmful. There was a study last year that came out, and the headlines were, marijuana more harmful than previously thought to teenage brains. But when you look at the study, they injected teenage rats, adolescent rats, injected them with synthetic cannabinoids, not marijuana, not natural cannabinoids, and then promoted this as a study about marijuana. So there's just a whole level of deceit and dishonesty, and we really need to get over that and begin to look at this scientifically. Barack Obama vowed when he took office that he would put science over ideology, and he made a big production about that he wasn't going to be like the last president and he was going to go for science. But he's failed. And someone really needs to make a change, and one place to start is to eliminate the blockades to doing research into the benefits of marijuana. And I think to legalize marijuana on a state-by-state basis. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you. For our listening and viewing audience, we're listening to a talk by Clint Verner, author of Marijuana, Gateway to Health. And now this talk is open for questions and comments. Please come to the microphone on the right here. And I have a question to start with. Although research on the health benefits is limited in the United States, what about European countries and other countries? There must be some research going on in other places.
That's where most of the research has been done. There's still blockades internationally and prejudice against using human subjects to study cannabis, but most of the studies that have shown benefit and have been aimed to find benefit have been done in Italy, Israel, Spain, Thailand. It's not here because you can't do studies to show benefit. The studies we have here that show benefit were intended to show harm and had this serendipitous result. And they're pretty frequent. Let me just say there was a study they wanted to show that marijuana amplified the damage to teenage brains from alcohol when there was polydrug abuse. So they wanted to prove that marijuana made the alcohol more harmful, but they found that actually using marijuana conferred a significant protection against the alcohol brain damage, that there was significant reduction in alcohol-related brain damage if the teenagers were using marijuana.
Thank you for that excellent overview. You mentioned, ironically, that Cheech and Chong would not get cancer, but the news last week was that Chong actually has prostate cancer and reportedly is treating it with hemp oil. Can you discuss hemp oil as a treatment for cancer?
Okay, hemp oil. Some people think it's a misnomer to call it hemp oil because a lot of people get hemp oil at Whole Foods or the natural food store and it's extract of the seed. But this refers to a highly concentrated extract from marijuana where a pound of really potent marijuana buds have the active oils, the cannabinoids extracted and concentrated down. And there is a huge movement that is called The Cure, where hemp oil, cannabis oil, is being promoted as a cure for cancer. And I personally have problems with that because I think cure is a huge word. I was going to call my book How Cannabis Prevents Cancer and Alzheimer's Disease, but upon reflection, I realized it's not the right word to use because prevention is a huge word, a huge hurdle to get over, as is cure. So the science supporting this is solid. I mean, it's not incomprehensible that if you flood your body with cannabinoids from marijuana and you have cancer, that you're going to get some powerful anti-tumor activity. And I know someone who has recently been cleared of lung cancer who was doing this with cannabis oil. She was also doing chemotherapy and dietary therapy, but still it's a pretty amazing recovery she's had. But we need to research it. We can't research it because it's illegal. And if you have cancer, I would say go ahead and take the oil, but do effective traditional therapies too.
The California Medical Association has a technical advisory committee which is called Legalization and Taxation. And actually that the California Medical Association supported legalization and taxation as the best way to manage cannabis. I think one question that comes up is it's currently a Schedule I substance, as you mentioned. Should it be rescheduled? Should it be a drug? Should it be treated as a dietary supplement or a botanical with regulations like tobacco and alcohol? What's your thinking as to the best?
I think it needs to be descheduled, the harm that comes from it. I'm not saying that there aren't any harms. Young people can get distracted from developing, you know, their life skills if they use it. Some people can get in a small percentage of people can get in a bad relationship with it. I say if you're sitting home doing bong hits and watching reruns of SpongeBob all day, you've probably got a problem. But there's just nothing, you know, that is so harmful that it should be regulated other than maybe some age restrictions. I do think it should be treated more as a botanical and have some restrictions.
Hi, thank you for speaking today. Earlier, you mentioned something about Andrew Weil doing studies on the advantage and disadvantages of marijuana, and he did the studies in Boston College.
Yeah,
I was, and the study actually showed that it actually increased the physical activities or physical performance of people who are actually doing it. I think that's my interest because I'm a physical therapist and I'm also a personal trainer. I wanted to know what do I tell people? What kind of physical activities and performance are they expecting to improve?
This was tasks. They performed tasks more efficiently if they were regular users, if they were under the influence of marijuana. In terms of physical activity, certain marijuanas are more stimulating and certain are more relaxing. There's sativa and indica. One thing I will point out, though, just sort of an offshoot of your question, is that there was a drug developed that blocked cannabinoid receptors in order to cause weight reduction to counteract the munchies. And when people took this drug that blocked their cannabinoid receptor activity, they had nausea, vomiting, panic attacks, depression. There were a couple of suicides in the test subjects. And there was a significant increase in falls, contusions, whiplash, car accidents, all sorts of accidents. And then there was a couple of studies that show that marijuana users have a reduced likelihood of visiting in emergency rooms for injuries than non-marijuana users, and that the more marijuana used, there is a proportionate decrease in the likelihood of having injuries. And it seems strange, but if you understand the endocannabinoid system, it deals with balance, coordination, and if you have a well-nourished endocannabinoid system, it's very likely that you're a little more balanced and coordinated. This also may speak to the data that came out recently that found marijuana drivers are very, very safe drivers, are actually far safer than anyone on alcohol and maybe a little safer than people who aren't on marijuana.
Yeah, I'm also a caregiver to my mother who's actually on an early stage dementia. Does it make an end? She doesn't smoke. Does it make any difference if she takes it in brownies?
No.
She loves brownies.
She could. Actually, I would suggest someone like that could use tinctures, which is sort of what was traditional before it was outlawed. It's a suspension in alcohol and can be put into a tea or under the tongue. And it can be delivered without reaching a level of psychoactivity. You can get to the point where she's not going to get high. Also, CBD tempers the psychoactive qualities of THC. So if you get a remedy that has CBD, which also enhances the activity of THC, then you're not going to have as much concern about her getting high.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a follow-up to that question, can you talk about other modes of delivery, like these new ways of volatilizing it, so that people who don't want to take products of combustion into their lungs might have other modes of delivery? And is there any research on these other modes of delivery?
Yes. That was when the IOM, there was an IOM commission impaneled by Barry McCaffrey after he got slapped down for his Cheech and Chong nonsense. He had to back off because he was threatening to put doctors who recommended marijuana in prison. And he impaneled an IOM group to study marijuana, and they came out and said, yes, it's very effective. Make it immediately available to people with cancer and AIDS, which hasn't been done. But they also said that the problem is that you're getting harmful compounds when you combust and smoke marijuana. We need is a fast, rapid onset delivery system, which is the benefit of smoking is you get the effects quickly. You don't have to wait for digestion. So the marijuana community came up with vaporizers, all sorts of vaporizers. And what these do is heat the marijuana to the point at which the cannabinoids are liberated. There's one, the volcano, and it blows a stream of heated air up. It liberates the cannabinoids. They go into a bag. You take the bag off, put a mouthpiece on, and inhale. You get no combustion toxins. You get no carbon monoxide. You don't get the particulate matter. And there was a study by Dr. Abrams that confirmed this, that the levels are actually increased and linger in the blood a little longer, and you don't get the byproducts, the harmful byproducts. But even with the harmful byproducts, it's interesting that THC is strong enough to override those and still protect against lung cancer. And there's other, you know, the joy of the 215 and the liberalization of the laws here in California is people are, marijuana, it doesn't all have to go to the black market. It can come into the health market, and people are experimenting with juicing fresh marijuana and getting THCA that's not psychoactive because it hasn't been heated, and they can ingest far more of this THCA than they could THC, the active compound, but that it still has protective, beneficial biological activity, the production of the cannabis oil. You need to have a lot of that. So this legalization in California has really pushed sort of guerrilla research ahead.
Is the cannabinoid system involved in any way with the immune system?
It is. In fact, that was one of the interesting things that came out of some of Dr. Abrams' research was that he finally got to do his research on AIDS patients when he hid his study as an assessment of harm and had secondary values that showed benefit, sort of a Trojan horse study. So he found that actually cannabinoids improved the immune function of the people with AIDS. And there's a study that just came out recently that found that they inhibit the ability of the AIDS virus to infect cells. Now, that's not really boosting the immune function, but it's boosting resistance to AIDS. And it is so, and they are so integral, yes. They work with every aspect of health, including bone preservation. It may be that THC fights osteoporosis because there's some evidence that cannabinoids help secure and maintain bone.
Thanks for a very good talk. I wanted to ask if you had any comments about a product called Sativex, which I know is available in the UK and other European countries. It's a mucosal spray being used for spasticity in MS and other indications.
So Sativex is, well, let me just say, I visited Sativex's growing facility in Great Britain several years ago, and they grow marijuana that is uniformly produced on tables in giant greenhouses. They have lighting systems, but they use natural light, and they have shutters that close to trigger the flowering process, bring it into darkness. And they have these tables and tables, warehouses of marijuana plants, and they extract the cannabinoids somewhat similarly, not in the same way, but a similar idea to the hemp oil, the cannabis oil that's been produced, and then produce it into a sublingual medicine that you spray it under your tongue and it's absorbed. They've done great research. They've probably got a great product. The only problem I have with Sativex is that sometimes I worry that they want to rely on prohibition to maintain market monopoly, and that the government wants to use Sativex to maintain prohibition. In other words, they're going to say, you don't need your medical marijuana. We have this pharmaceutical product that costs 100 times what it would cost you to get a comparable product that's been produced in your community and tested in your community and vended in your community. But here, this is the only way you can get your cannabinoids. So I welcome them to produce the product because there are people who are going to want a more pharmaceutical product to use and are going to want to make sure they can avoid psychoactivity. But we don't need it. I mean, we're doing really well here. Locally, we have testing labs that check for potency levels and contamination. We have people who have developed their own sublingual sprays. We have pills, we have capsules, we have foods. So I'm glad they've done the research, and I don't begrudge them a marketplace, but I don't want them to have a monopoly maintained by prohibition.
I'm a medical marijuana user for chronic pain, and it just works sometimes when opioids don't. And you didn't talk much about pain reasons, but what is the efficacy? Why does it happen? Is it psychosomatic, or what's going on with the pain control?
I can't get into depth about that, but it is not psychosomatic. That's what a lot of opponents were saying about medical marijuana before we knew about the endocannabinoid system. Nothing works on such a broad range of ailments. They're just getting high and forgetting that they feel bad. No, it has powerful anti-inflammatory activity. It seems to work in some fashion on the chemistry of the nerves and their signaling. And, again, Dr. Abrams did a study of the interaction of cannabinoids with opiates and found that there is a potentiation of the opiate's effect on pain that's beyond what you would expect from just a simple interaction. In other words, there's a dynamic that really ups the response and can lower. And opiates don't work so well in neuropathic pain, but cannabinoids do. So I can't tell you exactly the chemistry of it, but it does work through signaling, the signaling system, and conveying information.
You talked about the medical positive impact of marijuana, but what if children, because I know several who told me in schools the majority of their friends already smoked marijuana. What if on parties, because they say on parties we smoke and we drink alcohol, what happens? Isn't that dangerous?
It's not physiologically dangerous for them. in terms of toxicity. The point I make, Norman Mailer had a great quote. He says, I always tell my kids, marijuana is great for making associations for the brain, for letting you think about things, for having great ideas, but fill your brain with things to think about before you start using marijuana. And that's the problem for young people, is if they start using it regularly, they won't, that they'll get in a cul-de-sac and miss the opportunities to develop skills, to find out where their interests lie, to develop the skills within these interests to create a career. And that is the concern. If youngsters are using it occasionally, if they're getting good grades, if they're active and have interests, I don't think it's a tragedy. It's not like alcohol. It doesn't cause brain cell death, doesn't damage the liver, doesn't cause any sort of physiological impairment other than the, you know, the high, the inebriation in a sense. But I just say young people should stay away because they're not mature enough to regulate their own use frequently. I think that we need to have the conversations with them. Instead, part of the problem is if you tell them it's dangerous, it's horrible, don't use it because it's going to cause damage, and then they see it doesn't, then they have. But if we start to talk to and have this conversation about what it really does and why the good reasons are that they should wait, then you might make some inroads with them. And if they're drinking alcohol and using marijuana, at least they're protecting their brains from the alcohol that the is doing.
Our thanks to Clint Werner for his talk today on the medical uses of cannabis. And now this meeting, the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 109th year of operation, is adjourned.